to talk about effects of emtyrosin on feeding and survival of Formosan termites. As we all know, Formosan subterranean termites, which is called Captotermus formosanus, is an introduced pest in the United States, which is believed to be introduced during World War II from Asia. It's a major wood and structural pest, especially in southern United States, which attack living trees as well as dead and dry woods. Because of large colony size and aggressive feeding behaviors, these Formosan termites have caused great economic damage, and different types of control practices have been used since long time, which include chemical and physical barriers, different types of wood preservatives, and use of termiticides, and lately the use of baiting systems to eliminate termite colonies have been very popular. Generally, termite foods are rich in cellulose and low in nitrogen content because their primary food material is wood products. Previous experiment done by Chen and Henderson, they found that some of the amino acids like the aspartic acid, glutamic acid, proline, isoleucine, lysine have been found to have increased feeding on termites, and other amino acids like glycine, methionine, leucine, alanine, they had neutral effects on termites feeding. Not only in Captotermus but in Nathamitermes tubiformes also, the addition of dietary amino acids have increased feeding. The amino acid of concern in this experiment is M-tyrosine, which is C9H11NO3 with molecular weight 181.19. The oral LD50 dose in rat is very high, which indicates that its toxicity to mammal is very low, mammalians is very low. It's a white crystal which is soluble in water. Long ago, one experiment done by Aronson and Wilmers found that this M-tyrosine suppressed growth and development of some of the bacteria, and recently, one experiment by Weston and his colleagues found that M-tyrosine inhibited the growth and development of some of the weedy species, and they termed it as a potential bioherbicide or green strategy. So we are interested to find out the effects of this amino acid, especially on termites, and set the objectives to find out effects on feeding and survival. We conducted both no choice test and the choice test in this experiment. The no choice test consists of 4 different doses of M-tyrosine with control as water treated control. The experimental arena consists of simply petri dishes with filter paper on it, which consists of 20 grams of sand and 2 ml of water, and the filter paper is treated with 270 microliter of treatment solutions, and we introduced 22 termites at the rate of 10% soldiers, and the experiment was conducted in 6 replications. The experimental arena looks like that, where the petri dishes are placed inside a humidity chamber to maintain relative humidity and covered with aluminum foil to make it dark and facilitate foraging, and kept on an undisturbed place in the laboratory at 24 plus minus 1 degree Celsius. And we recorded feeding and mortality rate at regular intervals, and then at the end of the experiment, we recorded survival or mortality of the termites and the filter paper consumption. The result, we found that the consumption of filter paper was significantly low on the filter paper treated with 0.05 molar of M-tyrosine. Though the filter paper consumption was low in other cases, other doses of M-tyrosine also, but the difference was not significantly higher compared to control. Regarding survival of mortality of the termites, we found significantly high mortality. Only 35% survival of the termites was recorded on the filter paper treated with 0.05 molar, and in other doses also, they have some mortality, but the difference was not significant. To further justify this experiment, we conducted choice test to see what the termites will do if they have choice of not feeding on the filter paper treated with M-tyrosine. This test consists of four doses of amphotericin and water treated control. The experimental arena consists of 80 grams of sand and 10% moisture, and each filter paper is treated with 80 microliter of treatment solutions. Then we introduced 55 termites at the rate of 10% soldiers, and we conducted it in two colonies of the termites with 6 replications per colony. And we recorded number of live and dead termites at every 3 days interval and the health of the termites. Then at the end of the experiment, we recorded filter paper consumption and survival or mortality of the termites. Here we found that amphotericin treated filter paper consumption was very low. In these two cases, the consumption was almost nil. And in these two cases, still the consumption was very little, and they were all significantly different than the control. However, we didn't record any mortality in choice test. In both no choice and choice test, we noticed that termites were not repelled nor they attracted. And because all the termites were walking equally on the treated filter papers as well as on the untreated filter papers or control, but almost no consumption of the treated filter papers was there. And all doses of amphotericin have negative effects on termites feeding, but higher the doses, higher the effect. In no choice test, termites were forced to feed on the filter paper treated with amphotericin. So death resulted within 6 days. Means in 6 days, the termites started to die. However, in choice test, termites had option not to feed on the filter paper treated with amphotericin. So we didn't record any significant mortality in this choice test. And you can say that this amphotericin caused as a stomach poison, but not as a contact poison on Formosan termites. This finding is in consistence with the finding of Weston, who found that amphotericin inhibited the growth and development of some of the weedy species in lawn. And he termed it as a potential bioherbicide or green strategy. And with the experiment of Arson and Wormus, who found that this amphotericin suppressed the growth and development of bacteria. And probably we can relate it with the protozoans present on the guts of Formosan termites, but actually we didn't do any such experiments to relate this. And to compare these amino acids with other amino acids, for example, Chen and Henderson, they found that some amino acids were attractive, like D-aspartic acid, L-glutamic acid, and other amino acids like glycine, L-methionine, leucine, alanine, they were neutral on termites feeding. However, the D-aspartic acid, when continuously fed for more than 30 days, then it recorded some toxic effects on the same termites. Not only in this Formosan termites, some amino acids like proline and aspartic acid also attracted to Neotermis bossi also. But this amphotericin, the effect of this amphotericin is seemed quite completely different compared to these amino acids. So in conclusion, we can say that amphotericin is a feeding deterrent and acts as a stomach poison to these Formosan subterranean termites, and it has a practical significance as a promising wood preservative. Yeah, I'd like to extend my sincere thanks to my colleagues, Entomology Department and LSU Ag Center, Louisiana State University. Thank you.
I want to say thank you to Dr. Gold and the unit at Texas A&M and the folks that helped us, and then the fine folks at the ABC Pest and Lawn Services. One other note, too, this project did start in the late 90s with Rome Polonc when they had the pending Termidor label and the research going on, and it's lived through, this project has to go through, what, 4 mergers, which is better than all the employees have done in those time frames. A little bit about Termidor. We've heard a little bit about it. Of course, the active ingredient is fipronil. We were looking at residential structure treatments with activity being there at the time of treatment. and looking also at the efficacy of these treatments over time as well as initially, and then taking soil samples and analyzing those for residues. And at the end, of course, we'll go, if we have time, we'll have a little bit of questions. Fipronil belongs to a class of chemistry known as the phenylpyrazoles. The family itself are called the fiprols, and Jody talked about metabolites. They will be considered as part of the fiprol family. Some of the statistics, and you know, this is kind of neat, just look at a time frame of how something comes from development to market. And really, 6 years from development and the first synthesization in 1987 to commercial use in France is actually fairly quick. And you can see it's a broad spectrum insecticide used in crop production protection as well as in urban situations also. And it can be used in quite low dose rates to provide the control that we need in the environment. Some of the qualities of it that make it work as it does, certainly mentioned earlier about the non-repellent nature of the material. The insects can go into those treated zones, interact with those active treatment areas. And then we even get a little bit of horizontal transfer that occurs at many times. It's very good activity by contact as well as by ingestion. And we get some residual natures depending on the environment in which it's put. And the mode of action is a little unique as a GABA blocker. Some of the things that play in the characteristics of long-term persistence is, you know, what is the mobility of the compounds that we're looking at? Are they water-soluble, not water-soluble? How do they bind to the soil? Is there a vapor pressure that we're concerned about that may leave the environment we put it on? And also the half-life itself and how it reacts within the different soil pHs. These are some of the things that can affect persistence of various types of liquid insecticides. If we looked at sorption to soil, that's a very critical part of it. Because when we apply a termiticide to a soil, it can bind to the soil, it can bind to surfaces, it can interact with the plant root zone, it may get into a water profile. These are all the opportunities it may actually interact with we need to look at. We have some other work ongoing with Texas A&M helping us evaluate some of that too. And we can look at the soil sorption coefficient, and one of that would be like, what's the concentration of the AI that's stuck to the soil, sorbed to the soil, versus that concentration that might be in solution. And we can use that to measure that sorption coefficient. Then we can relate that directly to the organic carbon concentration, and that'll give us another comparison we can do between different active ingredients. And if we look at some of the characteristics of the active ingredients that are available, commercially available materials now, you can see, for instance, bifenthrin has a very high soil binding KOC. It's going to stick hard and not move. Certainly, chlorpenifer, cypermethrin, chlorpyrifos, and the fiprols are all in that way too. And permethrin a little bit less, and imidacloprid a little bit less also. And you can kind of see some of the ranges. Usually greater than 1,000 we consider as being materials that would bind strongly to the soil. Water solubility is another thing we look at. Certainly if it doesn't bind to the soil, but yet it's not water soluble, it still may stay there for quite a long time and then have the binding forces over time. They will accumulate. And really the materials that we use across the board, with possible exception, imidacloprid, we get very, you know, very low water solubility. Even imidacloprid has a moderate water solubility. But still, if it doesn't go into the water solubility itself or doesn't get solubilized, there's less chance of leaching and moving. And the other question is volatility. And really all the products that we use now across the board have a very low volatility rating, and the chances of them gassing off and going into a non-target arena are quite low. Persistence is the other factor that we want to look at. We want to look at the half-life of these materials. When fipronil was first being evaluated, of course, it's looked at a lot in agricultural situations. And in ag situations, even when they treat the soil and then incorporate it or roll it over, we get half-lives anywhere from 3 to 7 months. And, you know, it depends a little bit on the organic carbon type of soil and how it's incorporated. But there is that's persistent half-lives that we see. Now, termite control treatments, that's different. I know a lot of early work with chlorpyrifos, with Durzban. When we dig a trench, incorporate the soil, roll it over, we even get longer half-lives with a lot of our materials that are out there. And, you know, we want to look at some of the material, look at fipronil and see how persistent it is. Also, I would mention it's quite active. Jody had some great work showing the LD50s earlier on that, and of course that's relative to how long the exposure time is. I believe Texas A&M has done some of their minimum inhibitory concentration tests, and they've seen 3 parts per million. Some of the earlier stuff that we've seen published has been as low as 0.8 micrograms per termite, depending on exposure times. And there was mention of metabolites earlier. We do have some metabolization that will occur with fipronil over time, and the point I want to make here is that with these different types of metabolites, 3 of those are certainly active to termites. So that can give you extended control of termites over time through the metabolic process. So here's the treatments. We had 13 homes in the Austin area. They were all active with eastern subterranean termite infestations. We had 7 WG treatments and 6 SC, just formulation differences. Still the same amount of fipronil per 0.06% per area. And we had the Rhône-Poulenc pending Terminator label that we followed in 1998. And you can see we did inspections at 1 week after treatment, then 3, 6, 12, and all the way up to 96 months after treatment. Took tank samples at the initial mixing time, soil samples pre and post treatment, and we ran bioassays, of which Chris Kiefer and his student paper gave some data here earlier in the meeting, and then I'll give the residue analysis data for all of these samples that were taken. These were all monolithic slabs, shallow beams, shallow footers, basically dug a trench into the treatment. Didn't need to rod down to any depth because they didn't have any deep foundations. Trenches were 6 inches deep and usually 4 to 6 inches wide is where the range was for that. Minimal rotting because there wasn't any depth to go, and you can see the kind of gallons that were required for these treatments. These were exterior perimeter treatments. Almost all activity was associated, in fact, all activity was associated with the exterior walls. Most of the time it was on the outside. A couple of them was on the outside and the inside. There's always an exterior wall these were affected with. This is the calculation I used to calculate the half-life, and I'm going to give some data showing half-life from day one through time. So it's always from day one through time. And that kind of affects the how you look at it, because over time, the material that's remaining will bind stronger, so it increases the time of your half-life. There's the calculation that I did use. First of all, did it work? Well, definitely from the time of the very first activity or very first inspection after treatment, there was no activity all the way through 8 years after treatment. So it has been successful. We have been able to inspect these sites throughout all these time frames, not lose any sites to real estate transfers or anything of that nature. Looking at the actual residues, and this is by house, and this is the, I believe, the WG treatments. You can see we start with about somewhere around 50 part per million, 40-50 part per million. And then we get a nice degradation curve, and this is fipronil itself down through 8 years after treatment. Very similar profile that we see with the fipronil residues for the Terminator SC. The untreated control soils that we did take and test were analyzed. There was no fipronil in there, and we also ran the bioassays with them, and the termites did go through them with no significant mortality compared to controls. So that tells us that the soils themselves were not affected from a previous treatment of either fipronil or another material that might be compounding our effects here. Putting the WG and SCs together over the houses and averaging them, you can see a very good profile starting around 40 to 50 part per million from 1 week after treatment, and then dropping with the degradation profile through 8 years after treatment. Now, if we bring those both together and put the SC and the WG together and average those across the board, you can kind of see the kind of profile that we're looking at 1 week after treatment through all the way out to the 8 years after treatment. And then we can see the average. We're supposed to use the mouse, right? There we go. And down here, this is our part per million that we see in the soil profile for the averages over time. And you can see it is degrading over time. Now, what does that mean for half-life? And once again, the way I calculated the half-life was from day one, and then like this would be day one through 1 year, day one through 2 years, day one through 3 years, and this is half-life in months. And as I indicated earlier, when you have a material that stays in the soil over long periods of time, you will increase your half-life over time because of the cumulative binding factors that we have in the soil itself. And we saw this with early work with Dersman and other materials too. With that, to conclude, the structures were not only they were controlled over through 8 years after treatment, but also very quickly within 1 week after treatment. No activity over that time. Definitely we have a constant fipronil degradation profile in these soils over time. These were sandy clay and some silty clay loam soils. And we see some enhanced half-lives compared to the agricultural data that we see that's published in papers. And that is normal to what we see with termite work over time. And half-lives will increase as the material sits in that soil over time and binds these cumulative factors. With that, any time for questions? All right, thank you.
We have about a minute for questions.
Way in the back. The question, and if this is wrong, please restate it, but the question, I believe, was what condition would provide for the fastest type of degradation?
Yeah.
Would you suggest? Okay. Definitely, if you had the soil with the lowest amount of organic matter in probably the highest pH you could get, somewhere around 9, 10, 11, something like that. It'd be very high pH. And then with that, a high temperature profile, that would challenge just about every active ingredient, including fipronil, over time. Yes? Yeah, one of the degradation pathways on here is a biotic, a microbial degradation pathway we do see. Fipronil goes through the fastest form of degradation by photolysis, which is not going to be the biggest concern when you put it into a profile of soil, because you're not getting the UV light to hit it. But that's why you don't have 8 years of control on a concrete surface versus a soil profile. So, thank you, Susan.
Way of introduction, there's a great deal of literature that deals with the borates and borate-treated wood. Some of the literature would indicate that it has pretty good potential in terms of protection of wood. Others of them deal with the fact that it takes very specific conditions in terms of a great deal of moisture in the wood in order to possibly be effective. And as indicated by Grace and Tomato in 1994, they described the borates as merely a shell treatment. Sue and Chaffron basically talk about the problems associated with low wood moisture in structural timber, which would limit the movement. Takara and Sue in 1993 demonstrated some interesting things concerning the borates, indicating that the eastern subterranean termite had an LD50 of approximately 141 parts per million, whereas the Formosan subterranean termite required 256. Kaler, in a publication in 2007, indicated that he would not be recommending standalone borate wood treatment based on the research that they had done, both in using a method that utilized a color kit provided by NYSIS Corporation as well as bioassays. NYSIS has rebutted the findings of Kaler, indicating that the NYSIS kit with the curcumin was designated for only the highest levels of borate supplied and not suitable for looking at penetration. Our dilemma came when the Structural Test Control Board in Texas, effectively on January 8, 2007, wrote a requirement that borates could, as a matter of fact, be used in lieu of a full, partial, or abate treatment. This caused some concerns to those of us involved in the research, because of the fact that there was very little to no empirical data from the state of Texas that would justify this registration, even though that I served as a member of the board at that time. What was provided was testimonial data provided by the manufacturers of the borates that were available for Texas, and eventually the use of borates was approved by the board. Our objectives in this particular study were to study and evaluate the penetrations of the glycol borate, Boracare. It applied at a 1-to-1 dilution in southern yellow pine, which is commonly used in construction in the state of Texas, under optimal penetrating conditions, which I'll describe in but a moment. We also were interested in evaluating the mortality of subterranean termites that were exposed to the borate-treated surfaces, and thirdly, to evaluate the wood damaged in what is known as over-tunneling by subterranean termites on the southern yellow pine under laboratory conditions of two borate-containing products. In terms of the methodology, the dilutions of the Boracare were 50% volume to volume. They were topically applied to the southern yellow pine board. We had 5 replications of all of the treatments. There were 2 applications of the products. They were applied the first time, allowed to dry for 30 minutes, and all surfaces of the board were treated a second time and allowed to dry. Following treatment, the boards were cut into 10 centimeter blocks and placed in a chamber to maintain moisture and in temperature, which I'll describe. Borates were then incubated under constant conditions of 29C and 85% relative humidity throughout the study. This would address some of the concerns that the earlier research had indicated in terms of requiring high humidity and higher temperatures to foster the movements of the borates into and through wood. This is the way that the treatments were made. The boards were new boards bought from a local lumber yard. After being treated and dried, 2 applications applied. They were cut into blocks, placed into the chambers that are indicated here. Here's one of the blocks. They were basically screwed to a petri dish here that was held above the sand level. The sand was kept moist and the temperatures were at 29C. So optimum conditions, if there was an optimum condition, in terms of penetration of the borates into the wood. In terms of the boards were also removed at specific periods of time, including two days, 4/8, and 12 months, and they were cut with a small blade or narrow bladed bandsaw into 3-millimeter sections. Samples of the wood were then taken from 5 levels, replicated 5 times. 5-gram samples were then sent out for analysis to the State Department of the Chemist's Office. I'll talk about that in just a second. The point trying to be here is that every effort was made to use uniform slicing methods to represent or take a representative sample of the wood, 5 grams being the minimum. The methods that were used for analysis were based on what was known as the boron, the hot plate method. Would indicate to you that anticipating some concern over the method that was used, we actually evaluated 2 different methods of analyzing for the borates. And the total borates were then in the, what is known as the hot plate method, were then looked at with spectrophotometry as indicated in the following. We looked at both the hot plate method and what is known as the reflux methods. This was all of the work was done by the State Office of the State, Texas Office of the State Chemist Protocol 24411, and found that both procedures were equal, with the hot plate method giving slightly greater detection in the lowest rates of the borates. So we used the methodology that gave the highest overall rates, even though there was no significant difference between the two methods. Bioassays were done on the same wood that I've described to you, wherein the woods were removed at the time intervals that were indicated to you. The termites were given the opportunity of feeding on that wood, and then we evaluated the mortality, feeding, and tunneling based on that testing. Statistical analysis, of course, was done on all of the data that was generated. Here's an example of the way that the bioassays were run. We used 500 Formosan termites were added to each of the treatment chambers. Obviously, they were placed in the sand, which was kept moist, and then they were allowed to feed for 30 days, after which the assemblies were taken down. The amount of damage was basically looked at visually and quantified, and we also evaluated the mortality resulting from exposure to the borates. The results are very straightforward, fortunately. In terms of borate penetration, not surprisingly, because it supports the work of other researchers using different methods. However, the method we used for detection was very precise.